Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, about news, about current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on contracts. Where is it in the law? When we come back. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. Now, the First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people, and the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities free from government surveillance. You know, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes and politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control, but you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. That's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from the political process, the politicians, lawyers, or the bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying, "You give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either," because the real power in America is in our courts, not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for the free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school, and it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge. Remember, the courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education, but if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Or you can call direct 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Alright, we're answering some questions that were raised by a listener named Ray. Ray asked, is it explicitly stated or recorded in any law, case, record, statute, code, etc., that this is indeed the fact? He wants to know if driver's licenses, voting registration, and social security numbers are contracts, and if so, is it expressly or explicitly stated or recorded in any case, any law, any record, any statute, any code? And I said, yes, it is. And last night I gave you an example of a case that came down out of Idaho dealing with driver's license. Now, keep in mind that government, that is, the legislative branch of government, when they enact a law, don't necessarily want the average Joe Sixpack American to know how that law impacts upon him, whether it's a tax or whether it's a seatbelt law. I remember a guy out in California one time was arrested and convicted for carrying a concealed weapon. And he got to code pleading it out, and he found out there were two exceptions to the law. Exception number one, if you were making a deposit at the bank, if you had your deposit slip and your deposit in your bank bag and you were on your way to the bank or on your way back from the bank after having made a deposit, you could be carrying a concealed weapon without a permit. If you were a licensed fisherman and you were going fishing, you could carry a concealed weapon. This is back in the 1960s, I guess. Keep in mind the law has changed from time to time, but after he had been convicted, it made him kind of mad, and he went out and looked. He said, if I'd have known that, I'd have made sure that when I was carrying that concealed weapon that I had a fishing pole and my fishing license with me. So oftentimes, a law is enacted with some but-seps in the law. But-seps. If the government wanted you to know how that law impacts upon you, they would explain that in the statute. The fact that they don't explain it in the statute shows that they're hiding it from you, doesn't it? And, you know, just a little common sense, you know, comes into play. In the statute that I cited to you last night, the average Joe six-pack truck driver does not know or understand how that law is applied. The policemen don't understand how that law is applied. The prosecutor didn't understand how that law was applied. The judge did, and the judge explained it to me. And when he explained it to me, then I could use that law the way it was intended by the lawmaker. Did it five times. And you can do it five times also, but you have to know how that law is applied. And it just so happened that the prosecutor didn't, so I took advantage of it. All right, let's take a look at another side of the story over here called adhesion contracts. I mentioned that last night, remember? What is an adhesion contract, anyway? What makes an adhesion contract something different than an ordinary contract, an ordinary meeting of the minds? Well, the Patriot community has been battling statutes requiring specific performance for many years now, and with wide and varying results. And we've been asking, well, where's the contract that gives government these powers over us? And receiving deafening silence in reply. For years, the states have been passing statutes that should only be administrative requirements for those whom they have the power to regulate. In order to enforce those administrative statutes upon everyone, the states simply made criminal statutes out of their administrative requirements, and they gave the police the power of arrest for violations of those statutes. Now, if a police officer had no power to arrest, how many people would get a driver's license? You see, without criminal sanctions, this type of law would be unenforceable, as the majority of the populace would simply not comply. However, over a period of years, we Americans have become accustomed to having a license for almost everything we do, to the point that the majority of Americans now assume that it must be for the good of society and that we have licenses, and so everyone must have them. So when a jury hears a license issue, the defendant must be guilty. Their reasoning is, well, since I have to license or have a license, then so does he. And they simply cannot comprehend anyone driving without a license. The driver's license is a good example of government regulation over all of us by contract. These contracts create the category of victimless crime, of which the number is growing daily, and every patriot has had or will have one of these contract crimes to contend with. And our listener, Raymond, wants to know, but what is your authority, Gordon, for making the claim that these are contracts? Well, when Congress enacts a law, and if it doesn't have constitutional authority to do so, and they prosecute you and convict you, then you have to have a contract in force, otherwise it couldn't be a crime. Let's just try one out, one I think everybody can grasp. You join the Army. You sign an enlistment contract. When you join the Army, you're going to sign an enlistment contract. And that enlistment contract divorces you from the Constitution and Bill of Rights and subjects you to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. You see, the military has a different judicial system. They have a different legal system than the rest of us called civilians live by. I suppose you all know that. What is it that brings you under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ? It's the enlistment contract. And that expires. You join for 6 years, and then it expires. And then you're a civilian again. If you want to re-enlist, you have to re-enlist. You have to sign a new contract. So the Uniform Code of Military Justice is a contract. It's a contractual arrangement that you make. If you're in the Army, you don't say to the sergeant, but I've got a constitutional right. You have to read me my rights. You have to tell me that I've got a right to remain silent. No, not in the Army. Not in the military. They don't have to read you your rights. You don't have a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. Or if you do, it's a statutory privilege. It's not a right under the Fifth Amendment. Same thing with the Fourth Amendment or the Seventh Amendment or on down the line. You know, when the sergeant comes in and says, open your locker, I'm going to inspect it. You don't say, well, go get a search warrant, do you? And that's because the Uniform Code of Military Justice is a little different than the Bill of Rights and the Constitution of the United States. Now, what about driver's license, though? I showed you last night that the driver's license is a contract. Now, I'm going to take a look at adhesion contracts, and I'm going to show you that all of these legal requirements are, in fact, contractual in nature. And that's because they're called contracts of adhesion, spelled A-D-H-E-S-I-O-N. Look it up in Bouvier's Law Dictionary. Here's the way they work. One of the great generalizations about social history is the thesis of Sir Henry Maine that the history of progressive societies may be described as a movement from status to contract. It says, quote, through all of its course, it has been distinguished by the gradual dissolution of family dependency and growth of individual obligation in its place. The society is gradually substituted for the family as the unit of which civil law takes account. Nor is it difficult to see what is the tie between man and man which replaces by degrees those forms of reciprocity in rights and duties which have their origin in the family, and that is contract. And that's cited from Maine's Ancient Law, pages 163 to 165. The citation comes from Kessler on Contracts of Adhesion, 43, Columbia Law Review, page 640, published in 1943. Now, with the decline of the free enterprise system due to the innate trend of competitive capitalism towards monopoly, the meaning of contract has radically changed. Society, when granting freedom of contract, does not guarantee that all members of the community will be able to make use of it to the same extent. On the contrary, the law, by protecting the unequal distribution of property, does nothing to prevent freedom of contract from becoming a one-sided privilege. Society, by proclaiming freedom of contract, guarantees that it will not interfere with the exercise of power by contract. Freedom of contract enables enterprisers to legislate by contract, and that is even more important. To legislate in a substantially authoritarian manner without using the appearance of authoritarian forms. Thus, standard contracts in the hands of powerful industrial and commercial overlords enables them to impose a new feudal order of their own making upon a vast host of vassals. Unquote. Kessler, Contracts of Adhesion, 43, Columbia Law Review, page 640. All right, so an adhesion contract is a methodology whereby we don't rely upon the Constitution or the powers of the legislature to enact law under the Constitution. We do it by the agreement of the parties. For instance, I'm not subject to the laws of Missouri in relationship to family law. I don't have a marriage license. I'm not subject to the laws of Missouri as it relates to business and business licenses because I don't have a business license. As long as I stay out of commerce, the state has the power to regulate commerce, not business. It just happens that most business is contractual and it's contracted or it's conducted in commerce under the Commerce Clause, making it the legitimate subject of the legislature and the police powers of the state. Now, if we would stay out of commerce, which I do, then you're not subject to those laws, those statutes, those rules and regulations that regulate those businesses, and that's called private business. Now, Raymond wanted to know, well, what are the sources? You know, if you just steer me in the right direction, he says, I've asked this question before, I didn't get a response. So if there's any reason why, please tell me. Maybe it's just a foolish question, or maybe you think that I'm too lazy to do my own research. If you'd point me in the right direction, I'll try my best to find it on my own. Okay, Raymond, get your pencil out. Write this down. here's where you go to find the answer to the question that you've asked. And so I'm going through this series of programs, and I'm going to these sources, and I'm going to cite them to you. But I can't cite them all. For instance, I cited for you Bouvier's Law Dictionary under contract, several pages. I can't just sit here and read all these pages over the air. Same thing with license. I can't sit there and read 10 pages on license. I'd lose my audience. So I'm going to let you do that. You read contract, you read license, and that'll tell you a part of the story. And you're going to get the answer from the sources of information such as dictionaries, legal encyclopedias. Write that down. Legal dictionaries, legal encyclopedias, admissions made by public officials, admissions that are made by public officials, personal observations and experience, code pleading the statutes, such as Idaho Code 49-29-27. We're going to cover Social Security is Voluntary, a treatise written by Larry Breecraft. Title 42 of the U.S. Code, Section 301 to 335. I can't read that whole section over the air, but I'm going to give you some citations from it, and I'm going to show you that Social Security is voluntary. The Social Security Act, with all of its laws, and listen, Ray, if you've got a Social Security number and you go out and work in commerce and you don't pay your Social Security tax, that's called tax evasion. You can go to prison for 5 years. Now, let me make a bold statement. George Gordon hasn't made a Social Security payment since 1978. Not a one. Haven't paid a dime. A quit. I want to emphasize, though, that I haven't worked in commerce since 1978. I quit. I rescinded my Social Security account number, stopped participating in the program. And you can do the same thing because Social Security is a voluntary program. But if you volunteer and you've got that Social Security number, it's like joining the Army. What you do while you're a member of the armed forces is not voluntary. When that sergeant says, here's what you're going to do, then you just salute smartly and do it. When the IRS says, you pay the Social Security tax, you shut up, fold your hands, and pay the tax. Now, of course, if you don't have a Social Security account, I've got a boy here, he's 42 years old. He's never had a Social Security number. He's never paid a dime to Social Security. He's never had a job. He's never worked in commerce. He's not subject to the Social Security law. That's because it's contractual. Social Security is not constitutional. It's extra-constitutional, and that's what an adhesion contract is. An adhesion contract is not constitutional, and it's not unconstitutional. It doesn't have anything to do with the Constitution. It's contractual. Judge Becker asked the question, Mr. Gordon, are you engaged in interstate commerce? He comes back and says, if you mention the word Constitution in front of the jury, I'll throw you in jail. Driver's license is contractual. I contracted into it. I have an agreement. I agree with my driver's license that I will obey all the traffic laws of Idaho. And, of course, the question when I didn't stop at the scale was, well, did you violate that statute? The answer was, no, I didn't violate it, but they can prosecute me. And they did, 5 times. I beat them 5 times. I wasn't breaking the law. I was not breaking the law that I had agreed to obey, and I was obeying that law. My truck was empty. The truck wasn't loaded. Now, the development of large-scale enterprise with its mass production and distribution inevitably led to a standardized mass contract. The usefulness of these contracts was discovered in the banking, insurance, and transportation businesses, and their use spread to all other fields of large-scale enterprise, into international as well as national trade, and into labor relations. The uniformity of the terms of contracts became an important factor in the precise calculation of risks. Risks, which are difficult to calculate, can be eliminated altogether. The standard clauses in insurance policies are the most striking examples of this attempt to select and control risks assumed under contracts. Pause right here. Workman's compensation insurance. You're an employer. The law requires that you carry workman's compensation insurance on your employees. I don't have any workman's compensation insurance. But then I don't have any employees. If you want to have a business in trade, commerce, business, and industry employing people, you have to have workman's compensation. And that's because Article 1, Section 8 grants Congress the power to regulate commerce. The employment of people who have social security numbers in commerce, dealing with Federal Reserve note commercial paper, in trade, commerce, business, or industry affecting a public interest as a commercial activity for which you can be regulated and controlled. George Gordon doesn't have any employees, doesn't deal in trade, commerce, business, and industry affecting a public interest. I don't have any workman's comp. If I had employees and or if I dealt in trade, commerce, business, or industry affecting a public interest, I'd have workman's comp. Because it's an agreement that you make when you get your business license. I don't have a business license. I operate a law school and no business license. Why? School's not open to the public. Not open to the public. Don't affect a public interest. Don't deal in commercial paper. Don't deal in public business. Now, there's more to the story. Out of this also came the widespread use of warranty clauses in the machine industry, limiting the common law remedies of the buyer to a breach of an implied warranty of quality, and particularly his right to claim damages. Standardized contracts have thus become an important means of excluding or controlling the irrational factor of a jury in litigation and belong in the same category as codifications. For a complete discussion on the subject, see Kessler Contracts of Adhesion, Some Thoughts About Freedom of Contract, 43 Columbia Law Review, page 629, 631 and 32, published in 1943. All right, now, Ray, you wanted to know, can you point me in the right direction? Write it down. Kessler, 43 Columbia Law Review, page 629. Page 631, page 632. This term, contract of adhesion, was first used in the United States by Patterson, the delivery of a life insurance policy, in the 33rd Harvard Law Review, page 198 and page 222, first published in 1919. It was coined by Raymond Salelis as contract de adhesion to describe contracts in which one predominant unilateral will dictates its law to an undetermined multitude rather than to an individual. As in all employment contracts of big industry, transportation contracts of big railroad companies, and all those contracts which, as the Romans said, resemble a law much more than a meeting of the minds. Unquote. Salelis de la Declaration de Volente, 229, published in 1901. That's spelled S-A-L-E-I-L-L-E-S, comma, D-D-E, law, L-A, declaration, D-E-C-L-A-R-A-T-I-O-N, D-D-E, Volente, V-O-L-O-N-T-E, page 229. 1901. See if you can find that publication. It was in the law library in Boise, Idaho. That's where I got it. Now, here's another interesting subject matter that comes from the common law remedies of the buyer, limiting the common law remedies of a buyer to a breach of an implied warranty of quality. Ever go into Walmart and you buy a toaster? And in the toaster box, there's a warranty card. And then the clerk in the store says, here, fill this out. Make sure you fill out this warranty. You ever heard the word guarantee? Heard the word warranty. Why do you fill out the warranty card? Well, so that if the toaster doesn't work, you can get it replaced or repaired. And that's true. A warranty is, in fact, a guarantee. But it's more than a guarantee. It's a bilateral agreement, whereas a guarantee is a unilateral promise. Now, what's the difference? Well, here's the way that works. Let's suppose that you come to my school and I say, I guarantee upon money back, you know, I'll give you your money back if you're not satisfied, guarantee that thus and such is true. I'm going to sell you this car with a money back guarantee, or I'm going to sell you this car and I guarantee it for 90 days. And if anything goes wrong with it, transmission goes out, I will repair or replace the transmission. That's a unilateral promise. That's a guarantee. A warranty is a bilateral agreement. It's you and I sign a contract, we agree to something. And it's used as a matter of law. And after all, that's what a law is. A law is an agreement between two people. A law is an agreement between the government and the citizen. It's an agreement. Somebody says, well, I didn't agree to the seatbelt law. Sure you did. You agreed to the seatbelt law. You're a registered voter. You voted some guy into public office. This guy in public office becomes your guardian in a guardian ward relationship. Somebody said to me, no, Gordon, you don't understand government. You don't understand how this works. You see, the representative or the senator is a public servant. You see, he works for us, the voters. We're the sovereigns, and he's our servant. And I always tell people, you know, I went to the same public school you went to, and I listened to the same lies that you did. And that was the same story that they told me. I'm fully familiar with the story, but that's not the way that works in law. Now, that representative went off to Jefferson City, and he enacted a seatbelt law. And I used to work in the legislature up in Boise, Idaho. I was a paid lobbyist for many years. I talked to those legislators up there for many years. I testified before the committees for years and years on dozens of different topics. And I can tell you from my personal experience, it's a guardian ward relationship in which when you go in and testify, you and a lot of other people go in and testify, then they report that out of committee. Goes to the floor and it'll be voted on, and it will be voted on as it is recommended from the committee. And the seatbelt law, when it's enacted, is there for the insurance company, and it's the insurance industry that lobbies for the seatbelt law to protect the claims window of the insurance industry. It doesn't have anything to do with the will of the majority of the people. See, I went in there with 102 witnesses to testify against the seatbelt law. 102 witnesses in the record. Two witnesses from San Francisco, not even Idaho voters, from the National Association of Insurance Underwriters, came in and testified with charts and graphs about how great the seatbelt law was. It was reported out of committee 7-2. 102 people who are all registered voters in the state of Idaho, at least two voters from every county in the state, all 44 counties, appeared at the hearing and said, we don't want the seatbelt law. It was reported out 7-2 in favor. And it was voted on by the Republican legislature and signed by Governor John Evans. And I understand how the game's played. I played the game for years. Nothing personal. Now, that's an adhesion contract. The insurance industry wants that law written into the books, and it applies to all licensed drivers. Now, let's suppose that you're not a licensed driver, you're just a passenger riding in the car. And the police officer, he stops the guy driving the car, and he says, that passenger over there is not wearing his seatbelt. I'm going to give you, Mr. Licensed Driver, a ticket. He doesn't give a ticket. He doesn't hail me into court. Test it. I'm just telling you. It's the licensed driver. I don't have a license. Nobody's going to bring a charge against George Gordon for riding in a car with a licensed driver not wearing a seatbelt. It's contractual between the licensed driver and the state. Test it. Drive down the highway in Texas, you Texans, where not wearing a seatbelt is probable cause. When the policeman stops you and points to the passenger that's not wearing the seatbelt, you say, well, give him the ticket. He's the one that won't wear the seatbelt. I told him to put his seatbelt on. He wouldn't do it. I'm wearing my seatbelt, officer. I'm a licensed driver. I'm wearing my seatbelt. Give that guy a ticket and see what happens. I'm going to show you how this adhesion contract works as it relates to the warranty. The General Electric Company files a document with the Secretary of State out in Hartford, Connecticut, and they write up the terms and conditions of the warranty. The warranty says General Electric is not responsible for death or injury that's caused by our toaster. You plug the toaster in and it killed you. You go into court and you sue General Electric and you say General Electric's toaster was faulty and it killed me, or it killed my wife, and I want $1 million in damages. Under the common law, General Electric is liable. But you filled out and signed the warranty card, remember? Now you've got a bilateral agreement, and you agreed with General Electric that you would limit their liability to the replacement or the repair of the toaster at General Electric's option. Boys and girls, that's a contract. That's a warranty. That's a law. That's the way the game's played. Hey, we're at the halfway point here. I got to stop and give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, biblical law, and scriptural law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement only. Prearrangement. The public doesn't just come here unannounced. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to the homeschooling page on the website. It's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio logs and schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. And remember, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And they can be downloaded free. If you want to play this on your radio station, be my guest. If you want to make a copy of it, 16 or 32-bit, go right to it. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Remember that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program or mine and mine alone, they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember the website georgegordon.org or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. We're talking about contracts. Where is it in the law? You know, George Bush is pushing a policy. He wants private Social Security accounts. That's not a conspiracy, that's public policy. But when you want to hide something from the public, you don't want to come right out here and tell them what it is that we're doing, because if you told them directly, they might not want to buy into the program. It's kind of like Social Security is voluntary. You don't have to buy into the program, but if you want to, you can. And Larry Becraft wrote a series of briefs. They may be on his website. If they're not, you can get to Larry Becraft's website, and it's, yeah, I wrote it down here too. Yeah, let me look it up here again. It's not Larry Becraft. It's kind of an odd name here. And he wrote a treatise here on, it's called Destroyed Arguments. And then he also wrote a series of articles or briefs. One of them's titled Comment Upon the Voluntary Nature of Social Security. And he cited 24 cases and proves conclusively that Social Security is voluntary. And you can come to the same conclusion. You simply go to the U.S. Code, Title 42, Section 301 through 335. Got that, Ray? It's Title 42, Section 301 through 335. Now, there's 24 cases that support Becraft's contention that Social Security is voluntary. Now, I can't read the whole thing to you. In fact, I've covered this just recently in a series of programs called Social Security. But I wanted to give you his website, and here it is. It's fly.highway.net. Now, here's the way you spell it. It's F-L-Y dot highway. H-I-W-A-A-Y. There's two A's in it. That's the thing that makes it odd. Dot net. Go to Larry Becraft's website, fly.highway.net, and see if they're already on there posted. If not, why don't you write him an email and see if you can get those two articles. One is called Destroyed Arguments. The other one is called Social Security, or Comment Upon the Voluntary Nature of Social Security. Now, let me show you the Social Security story here for a second. I'm going to cut into adhesion contracts, and let me read to you one paragraph. The modern-day act, Social Security, is codified at 42 U.S.C. Section 301 through 433. If there were any requirement that every American join the Social Security scheme, one would expect to find language in the act similar to the following. Now, here is a hypothetical. It says, every American of the age of 18 or older shall submit an application with the Social Security Administration and shall provide thereon the information required by regulations prescribed by the Secretary. Every member of Social Security shall pay the taxes imposed herein, and records of such payments shall be kept by the Secretary for determining the amount of benefits to which such member is entitled hereunder, unquote. Now, that's a hypothetical. It isn't in there. But Larry Becraft said, well, if there was such a requirement, you'd have to have wording to that effect. Amazingly, no such or similar language appears within the Act, and particularly there is no section thereof which could remotely be considered as a mandate that anyone join Social Security. The closest section of the Act which might relate to this point is the requirement that one seeking benefits under the Act must apply for the same, but this relates to an entirely different point than a requirement that you join Social Security. Okay, now I'm not a member of Social Security. I joined and I dropped out. I have a son that's 42. He's never been a member of Social Security, never had a number. 14 million Americans are not participants in Social Security. Some, like the Amish and Mennonites, do it for religious reasons, some for other reasons, and there it is. Now, let me assure you that Social Security's got some pretty powerful laws under the Title 26 income tax laws. And it's called FICA. And there's a requirement that if you make $400 a year, that you pay off your gross, 15.3%. I don't do that. 14 million other Americans don't do that because we don't belong to Social Security. Typically, we do it under First Amendment grounds, but most Americans have it. Now, let me tell you what the reaction is to the average Joe Sixpack on the street. I go to a doctor's office or a dentist's office, and they hand me this form to fill out, and I always fill it out. God, I just love it. When I get a form, I love to fill out these forms. It says, what's your name? I put in there, Harry Wolf, Joe Sixpack, IP Daily. And they want to know your address. And I put Fourth Amendment objection. They want to know what your Social Security number, and I write none. And they want to know, where are you employed? And I put retired. How much money do you make every year? Zero. And I answer all the questions. And I answer it Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, First Amendment, none of your business, kiss my rectum, and no, none, and never. And then I pass in my paper. It's kind of like third grade. Remember, you used to pass your paper forward? I pass my paper in. And inevitably, they'll come over to me and they'll say, well, Mr. Gordon, we can't process this. We can't put this into our computer. We can't file this medical information without your Social Security number. And I tell them, well, let's take a look there on line 2, where it says social security number, it says none, N-O-N-E. I spelled it correctly, and I don't have one. And inevitably they'll say, oh, you have to have one, Mr. Gordon, it's the law. People, honest to God, Americans believe it's the law. You have to have a social security number. Now, I'm not going to argue with you, Raymond, about Social Security. I don't care whether you have a number or don't have a number. I'm just telling you, Social Security is voluntary. And now I told you where to go find the information. It's Title 42, Section 301. Now read it through Section 335. Now, Larry's put Section 433. Seemed to me it goes to 435, but when you come to the end of the section, it'll read 433 or 435. And then send me another email and then tell me in that section there where there's a requirement that anyone goes down and signs up. And tell me what the penalty is. If you don't sign up for Social Security, there's a $3,000 fine and 5 years imprisonment or something. There's got to be some kind of a penalty there, doesn't there? And I think you're going to find out, like Larry Beecraft, there's no penalty because there's no requirement. And that's because there's no constitutional provision for Congress to enact a social welfare scheme like Social Security. And that's where the bottom line is. So what is Social Security? It's a contract. It's a voluntary application that you make. It's contractual. It's an offer by the government with an acceptance by you, and you go fill out the form. There's consideration called 15.3% of all of your income over time. It stretches from the time that you enact the contract until you get to be 65 or until you retire. And that's what a contract is. It's an agreement. In fact, I'll just read you the first paragraph. I told you to go to Bouvier on contract. The reason I like Bouvier is because Bouvier will tell you a story. It isn't just a definition. They actually give you a short story. And a contract over here, or a contractual obligation, let's see, there's 5 pages, and a contract here is an agreement between two or more parties to do or not to do a particular thing. So, the Social Security Act, the Social Security Law, the Social Security Contract. Now, see, they don't call it a contract. In fact, Larry Beecraft actually wrote a treatise here. And he wrote the comment upon the voluntary nature of Social Security. And then here at the end of it, he has a separate section that says Social Security is not a contract. Social Security is not a contract. And, you know, Larry's a nice guy and I like him. He's an old-timey buddy and we talk from time to time when we meet. And sometimes I tell him, you know, I don't agree with you. And I don't agree with him on that point. And he'll tell you why it is that he doesn't think Social Security is a contract, and I'm going to tell you why I think Social Security is a contract. I believe, Larry, that Social Security is a contract because it is voluntary. If the government had the power to compel me into Social Security under pains and penalties of death or prison or fine or something else, against my will and over my objection, that's not a contract. That's not an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. That's just compulsion. You'll do it, and that's the end of the argument. Social Security is a contract because it has the elements of a contract. It's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. And without all four of those indici, you don't have a contract. Just take a look at contract in Bouvier and it'll explain what contracts are. It has those four elements. Offer, acceptance, time, consideration. With any one of those missing, you don't have a contract. Now, not everybody agrees. I mean, hell, even the Supreme Court divides 5-4. And Raymond, if you think Social Security isn't a contract, that's fine with me. I'm not offended. But you know, I'm an old country boy, and if it's black and white, and stinks real bad, I call that a skunk. In California, they call them civet cats. I remember one time I told this guy, I said, there's a damn skunk coming up through the floorboards into the cabin. He says, no, we don't have skunks here. We have civet cats. Get it right, Gordon. That's a civet cat. I said, a what? He said, it's a civet cat. Get it straight. It's not a skunk. We don't have skunks in California. I said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. You know, where I'm from, boys and girls, they call those skunks. Now, the same thing applies to a license. When you have a license, when you have an adhesion contract, when you have a warranty card, that's a contract. Now, when you go to sue General Electric for wrongful death, you're going to find out you can't do that because you agreed to it. You're going to find out that you have a right to a jury trial in all controversies exceeding $20 until you get a credit card, and you find out there's a paragraph in the application to the credit card that says, we agree to binding arbitration. Same thing happens when you buy an automobile from GMAC. You'll find out you can't sue General Motors. You have to submit to binding arbitration. That's a contract. Contract. It's an agreement. I don't make it that way. I'm just a reporter, and I'm just reporting to you that that's the name of the game. That's the way it's done. So when you get a credit card or an automobile loan, you're going to find out that you have waived valuable civil and constitutional rights by signing that contract. Now, when you go into court, the judge is simply the arbiter of the terms and conditions of the contract. And he says, well, I want to point to this section of the law. Here's what the law provides for. But hey, boys and girls, you didn't have to submit. You didn't have to participate. Now let's take welfare fraud. You go down and you sign up for welfare and you sign an application and you say, I'm poor and I don't work and I don't have any money and I need these food stamps and I need this welfare payment. Now, the truth of the matter is you're out here working every day and you're making $3,000 a month and you're lying and you're defrauding the welfare people out of this money. And pretty soon they find out about that. And they come out and they prosecute you. They sue you. They do worse than that. They prosecute you with a criminal charge. They say this guy has committed welfare fraud. The welfare statutes, boys and girls, do in fact constitute a law, but that law only applies to people that submit to the welfare statutes. You can't charge George Gordon with welfare fraud. I've never gone down and signed a welfare application. You can't get welfare without a social security number. Just test it. Go into welfare and tell them I want welfare. And they'll say, what's your social security number? Tell them I don't have social security number. I'm a religious guy. I'm a Mennonite. And find out what happens. If you don't have a social security number, you're not getting welfare. So you got to be a member of the club. Now, did it ever occur to you that if you weren't a member of the club, you wouldn't be subject to the penalties of those laws? You're only subject to the penalties of the welfare laws if, in fact, you're a member of the welfare program. You're only subject to the social security laws if, in fact, you're a member of the social security system. You're only subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice if, in fact, you've signed an enlistment contract and you're a member of the military. See how those contracts work? I didn't make it that way. I didn't design it. I'm just reporting. It's the way it is. So you want to find out, well, where do I go to find this out? All right, so you go to Larry Beecraft's website. You want Social Security is voluntary, and you want destroyed arguments. There's a couple of articles from Larry Beecraft. But there's more to the story. Remember this contract de-adhesion to describe contracts? Well, it was popularized in the United States by scholars who were educated on the continent of Europe and who later taught in this country. Remember Kessler, Contracts of Adhesion, Some Thoughts About Freedom of Contract, 43, Columbia Law Review, 1943. And there's another guy in here, Ehrenzweig, E-H-R-E-N-Z-W-E-I-G, Ehrenzweig, contract, their adhesion contracts, in the conflict of laws. 53 Columbia Law Review, page 1072, published in 1953. Again, that's Ehrenzweig, Ehrenzweig, adhesion contracts in the conflict of laws. 53 Columbia Law Review, page 1072, published in 1953. Contracts of adhesion have at least three indicia, and they may even appear in combination. Number one, bargaining over the terms and conditions may not be between equals. One party may have such a strong economic power that it can dictate its terms to the weaker party. Number two, there may be no opportunity to bargain over the terms at all. This contract of adhesion may be a take-it-or-leave-it proposition in which the only alternatives are adherence or rejection. And three, one party may be totally unfamiliar with the terms and conditions. One party may have the advantage of time and expert advice in preparing it, while the other party may have no real opportunity to study the contract at all. This could even be compounded by the use of fine print and convoluted clauses. Amazingly, it can be concluded that, one, the state and the individual are not equals. And although the individual is sovereign, the state has the power position as it exercises executive, legislative, and judicial powers and lords them over the individual. The state dictates all of the terms to its feudal serfs through statutory legislation and administrative regulations. And two, there is no opportunity to bargain over these terms of any of these contractual legislative enactments. The individual is left with a vote between two evils, the result of which is still evil, and input during legislative sessions, which is usually ignored. However, the majority of the committee members hold the individual who attempts to influence legislation by and through committee action in general contempt and scorn. Sometimes the individual is even ridiculed and scolded by the committee chairman. And three, the majority of people are not even aware that any contractual liability exists from the statutes. The state is a corporate entity engaged in business, and the individuals of a state are its customers. The state has been perfecting its business rules for many years, while the individual simply bends like a reed shaking in the wind. The question which needs to be answered is, how does a statute become a contractual agreement? Where is the consent? Well, the answer should be becoming obviously. It is the implied consensual contracts between the states who make statutory contracts implied in law and the people based upon a fiction of law without the assent of the individual. So what is a contract implied in law? How do you imply this contract in law? Well, a contract implied in law is but a duty imposed by law and treated as a contract for the purposes of a remedy only. G.T. Vogel and Company versus U.S., cited at 135 Fed Supplement 2nd Edition, page 117, and this is cited on page 120. That's G.T. Vogel, F-O-G-L-E and Company versus U.S., 135 Fed 2nd, 117 at 120. An example of a duty imposed by law would be a marriage license, a building permit, a driver's license, thou shall not exceed 55 miles per hour, or any statute requiring specific performance. Contracts implied in law implies a promise to pay, whether or not any promise was made or intended. You'll see that in regarding Altman's will, cited at 266 NYS, that's New York Statute, 773, 779, 149, Miscellaneous 115. That's Altman's, A-L-T-M-A-N-N-S, will, 266 NYS 773. It's on page 779. Now, when the individual fails to perform, this is called a quasi-breach of contract, as the corporate state demands, and there must be a remedy. That's called a penalty, a promise to pay, paid to the state. We call those fines. And it's determined by the state's chancellor. We call him a judge. And as provided for in the contractual statute that you went down and signed up for in order to bring yourself under that section of the state statute. Also, since there is an implied contract, license, contracts, quasi-corporate status, such as an intent, need not be proven. So we don't have to prove intent, we just have to prove the act. So adhesion contracts, then, are a promise implied in law is one in which neither the words nor the conduct of the party that is involved are promissory in form or justify an inference of a promise, and the term is used to indicate that a party is under a legally enforceable duty, as he would have been if, in fact, he had made a promise. Ferris Products Company versus Gulf States Trading Company, cited at 323 Southwest 2nd, page 292. All right. Now, remember, Ray, I told you there's a number of places that you go. Sources of information, dictionaries, encyclopedias, public officials, personal observations and experience, code pleading. And I showed you Social Security is voluntary. I said go to Larry B. Kraft's website. And then you can get these quotations from sources such as magazines, papers, TV, radio, or the person, and by legal research, or George Mercier on invisible contracts and franchise. I'm going to cover George Mercier and invisible contracts. I'll give you a little introduction to that as we progress along. I'm about out of time here, and I won't be able to quite finish contracts of adhesion in this session, but we'll come back next time and we'll take a look at the constructive or quasi-contracts called adhesion contracts. Very important term. When you do, you're going to find out that laws, all laws, are predicated upon agreement. It's the consent of the governed. It's because you live in a democracy, remember? So in a democracy, we are governed by the consent of the governed. We elect our representatives. These representatives have a guardian-ward relationship. They make our laws for us. Dianne Feinstein goes to Washington and decides for you that you need this Patriot Act law. George Bush went to Washington and said, we got to have Homeland Security and a Patriot Act. You're bound by those laws. Those are called laws of general applicability. It's a guardian-ward relationship in which you're a citizen. The people of Germany aren't subject to those laws. People of France aren't subject to those laws. It's people of the United States. But when you join in with driver's license, welfare, social security, business licenses, those are adhesion contracts. Those contracts are a special form of adhesion contract. You join up for them. You won't have any problem with the highway patrolman unless you have a driver's license. You won't have any problem with the welfare department until you go down and sign up for welfare. You won't have any problem with welfare lady until you get a birth certificate for your child. You won't have problems with Social Security until you go down and sign up for Social Security or try to go to work for somebody without a Social Security number. Well, I'm out of time, boys and girls. As usual, we'll have to come back to this tomorrow night. Same time, same station. Remember, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Just go to our webpage, georgegordon.org. Remember, The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, we're about out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, talking about adhesion contracts. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.